So good afternoon. My name is Krister Schaum, and the work that I'll be talking about today was done in Ephraim's group at the University of Toronto, and it was carried out in part with Robert Adamson, at least the bulk of this work. And I'd also like to point out some of the theory work that I'll be talking about today was also done by Pete Turner, who's sitting right there and is our moderator. So I found out about doing this talk late last night, and I put most of it together over lunch, so it's not going to be very polished, and there might be some hand waving and use of the blackboard. So, but it's a workshop, so I figured that'll be okay. This is the way you like it. All right, I'll just waggle. So I'd also like to say that there have been three talks today that lead in very nicely to some of the stuff that I'll be speaking about, particularly what Joe and what he was talking about today. I'll be talking about a different visualization technique for density matrices on a Poincaré sphere, but for a different system that we worked out. And Dimitri, he just gave a talk on a lot of these states that you use for metrology and phase sensitivity, and that also ties in very nicely to the stuff we were doing. And also, I think Vladimir gave a talk early this morning where he was talking about compression, and a couple of those ideas clicked in too with some of the stuff that we've been thinking about with this. So the first thing I want to talk about is what we call triphoton states. And these are just simply states of three photons that are completely indistinguishable. There's no way to tell anything different about them, except we have one handle that we can use. We can control their polarization. And so I place these three photons into the same mode, and all I can say is whether I've got three horizontal photons, two, one, or zero, or some kind of superposition between them. And this is a four-dimensional system, and it is a, yes, that's what I want to say about that for now. The most famous of these is the so-called noon state, which has all three of your photons in one mode and all three in the other. And as we heard in the last talk, this has nice metrology sort of applications. And so, in fact, some of the results from that experiment were shown in Dimitri's talk. We finished up that experiment, and I think it was 2000, it was a while ago. And 2003? Okay. So Ephraim immediately said, well, you know, we spent a lot of time putting together an experimental apparatus, and we need to do more things with it because, you know, when you spend a lot of time putting something together, what else can you how many papers can you hammer out with it? He said, well, what's the most obvious thing that you can do next? And that is to do tomography. Go away, this should be a pretty simple task. And of course, nothing's ever as simple as your supervisor leads you to believe. And so it ended up taking a lot longer to do this. Before we get into this, I actually just want to take a moment and give you a quick overview of how we create these states. And part of it's interesting because we use loss to create our states. So, what? Oh, yeah, sorry. All right. So this is part of the motivation, but a lot of the motivation was done in the last talk. So noon states are interesting because they display the super phase sensitivity and super resolution. And people are interested in these type of things for anything where you need to measure a sensitive phase. This is LIGO, and it's this gigantic interferometer that's kilometers long, and they want to try and detect gravity waves. And one of they've done some absolutely superhuman things to try and make this work. The experiment's ridiculous, and I can't believe it actually does sort of work. And one of the things they've always said is, well, instead of using coherent states of light or classical states, why don't we use potentially squeeze states or something else that we can measure the phase better? And this is always the justification we use for this. I didn't think this would ever really happen. I thought this was something we'd tell like funding agencies and they would give us money. But it turns out just earlier this year, they've actually got squeeze states working to improve the sensitivity, and have, on a smaller scale system, not quite as big as this, been using it to drop below the shot noise limit. So there is some potential for some of these techniques. So that's just a giant picture of LIGO. Another thing people talk about is using these states for things like maybe lithography, so you can write smaller features. That's just a computer chip. And then you know, we could potentially put 3 times as many features on, or n times as many features. So we're going to use a couple of tricks to create our states. If instead of think, and I forgot the vacuum in here, but pretend there's a vacuum. If you instead rewrite your state instead of the general triphoton in terms of your creation operators, it turns out you can always factor a polynomial of this form into a polynomial of this form. And I think that's due to something called the fundamental theorem of algebra, which I learned about not too long ago. And if you want to take the mean state, so in this case, it's a mean state composed of 3 right-handed circular and 3 left-handed circular photons. You can rewrite it as this type of product state right here. And if you squint really carefully, you realize that these 3 things are just linear polarizations. So a right plus a left, and then this phase factor here, these all correspond to 3 different linear polarizations. And what they are is just a photon that's at 0, one that's at 60 degrees, and one polarized at 120. So what this says is if you can take 3 photons of these different polarizations, dump them into the same mode, then you've automatically created this mean state right here. So that is what we are actually going to use. Of course, taking 3 non-orthogonal quantum states and putting them into the same mode, that can't not be done unitarily. So in our case, we're going to have some loss. We can do this, but we have to accept that it's not going to succeed 100% of the time. Our general state preparation scheme is we are going to take a, we have a pulse Ti sapphire laser. This is going to come in, and we're going to double it through a BBO crystal. And then we're going to use type 2 spontaneous parametric down conversion. This produces a pair of photons. In this case, they're not entangled.
Theorem of algebra, the factorization, would that work for sort of any state of, you know, n photons? You could figure out a way to write it as just putting a bunch of single photons in the same mode?
Yep. It's scalable up. But you have to be careful with how you do it, because then you get into the efficiency questions too. But it's because you can't do this unitarily. But sure, it does scale. So you can apply it any large n. So our basic idea is what we're going to do is take 2 photons from down conversion. They're not going to be entangled. And then we're going to take a 3rd photon that's just going to be an attenuated laser photon. So it's not going to be necessarily an ideal photon source. And we're going to combine these 3 into the same mode. Before we do that, we're going to control the polarization. And then we should have, if we've done this correctly, created whatever state we want. So we take the 2 photons that come out of the type 2 down conversion. One comes out horizontally polarized. The other comes out vertically polarized. These are orthogonal. We combine them onto a polarizing beam splitter. And now we have 2 photons that are resuming along like this. We send them through a halfway plate. And now we have 2 photons like that. And we bring in our 3rd photon. And now we've got a state that looks well like this. You've got horizontal, and then 2 photons that are, this one's at 45, and that one's at minus 45.
So it's a 50-50 beam splitter?
No, this is, so here we use this as just a air-coated piece of glass. Because these photons are precious to us. They're the down-converted photons that happen quite rarely. This is just our attenuated laser. And so this also serves to be part of our attenuator. So we use this to split in the 3rd photon. And there's going to be some consequences to using a laser photon as opposed to real single photon sources. It's going to introduce some unwanted background terms in the end. But we can deal with that.
Excuse me, you call this 3rd beam the local oscillator. Isn't it a little bit misleading? Because I think that at the output of the beam splitter, the intensity is still comparable with the intensity of the 2 photon state. Well, I mean, the photon number is low. Usually when people speak of local oscillator, they mean something strong, something bright.
OK.
It's just an added photon, yes. Just a single photon state, essentially.
It's, I mean, yeah, we can control the rate. So, sure, this isn't like a strong, like, we're not trying to do homodyne heterodyning anything like that with this. So I'll call it the laser photon, if you like.
It is actually significantly stronger than the photon periscope.
Yeah, it is, but not like...
What is that?
Really big.
Stop right now.
So Ephraim's right. It is stronger, but it's maybe not in the same region as you might be happy thinking with, like... So when I say it's attenuated, you have to balance the probability of getting a pair here with the probability of getting a single photon in here for pulse. And this rate is really low, and this rate is also low, but it's higher. And so you want to, so.
So it's still higher, essentially.
It's still higher, and it's still like, like at least an order of magnitude higher. So if that makes you upset, I'll call it a laser. And I'm happy with laser. That's fine with me. So instead of, you might just say, why not just take three photons, change the polarization, put them into the same mode, and produce your states. Well, you can do that. It's just very inefficient to do it. So we came up with a more efficient way, which is going through this rigmarole of combining polarizers and beam splitters. And what we do to control our polarization is we put them through this thing called a variable partial polarizer. And so what this does is it's just a simple polarization interferometer. And the state comes in here. And we can either walk this horizontal path or this vertical path. So these are just two pieces of calcite. It's birefringent. The polarization is able to separate out, and you can create this interferometer. And we can attenuate selectively either of these orders. And by doing this, we introduce some loss. And that also, in turn, takes our polarization and rotates it into different polarization states. But we can't do this perfectly efficiently. We do get some loss. But when it succeeds, we rotate the polarization state to what we want. And so doing this, we can create a whole class of triphoton states. So this is the experiment that is set up. And we can create these states. But the question then becomes, how can I go to the next slide? The question becomes, how do we do tomography on this type of state? And so it's not obvious how you would go about doing this characterization, because you have all three of your photons in the same mode. It's not like they're in different spatial modes and you have other handles to grab them. So we started to think about what does the space look like? And in our case, we've got three photons. And I have four different possible states they can be in. I can have three H's, two H's, one H, or zero H. I can't tell anything about the ordering. They exist. So I have like a four-dimensional Hilbert space. So that's fine. You might just say, well, go ahead and characterize this 4x4 dimensional Hilbert space. But we're experimentalists. And in the real world, when you're trying to prepare these states, you're always going to get some kind of experimental error. So, you know, what this requires, this assumption, is that I've got three photons, and they're all exactly in the same mode. But this, you can't do in the lab perfectly. You might have created, say...
For this audience, that's a lambda, not a wave packet, right? No, probably not.
Okay, this is my photon. This is what I conceptualize as a photon of sorts. And so I might have two photons that are kind of overlapped, and then maybe a third one that I haven't brought in perfectly. So maybe their frequencies are slightly different, or the spatial overlap isn't quite correct, or you know the temporal overlap isn't good enough. And when you think about what happens if all three of the photons were completely distinguishable, maybe they're not distinguishable to my experimental apparatus, because I'm doing the best job I can to get rid of this extra distinguishing information. Well, then you just have three qubits, and this thing lives in an eight-dimensional Hilbert space. So all of a sudden you have this much, much bigger 8x8 instead of a 4x4. And this confused us because, well, we know that we're experimentalists and we can't do things perfectly, and that we should be able to, that our state really lives in this larger Hilbert space, but everything that we do, like our experimental apparatus is only sensitive really to these elements in terms of what we're trying to prepare for the most part. So we're kind of stuck. Like, where do you go from this, and how do you solve this problem? And this is another subtlety here is that anything that lives in this 4x4 dimensional Hilbert space has to be completely symmetric, and that's because photons are bosons. You put them all into the same mode, they have to occupy permutation symmetric states. There can't be any kind of asymmetry there. And when you think about how this, if you generalize this, say, go from 3 to 4 to 10 to whatever, the size of this permutation symmetric space, it scales as n plus 1, where this is your the number of photons that you put in. And so the number of elements that you'd have to characterize scales as this polynomial, whereas this other Hilbert space blows up really, really quickly. So already you have this interesting idea that you've got this n plus 1 scaling, this polynomial scaling, as opposed to this other, this exponential scaling, which we might want to look at. So we are quite confused about this. And luckily, Turner came in and Rob, they both sat down and they worked out a lot of the nitty-gritty details about it and involve lots of group theory, most of which I don't understand, but I can tell you the parts that my interpretation of some of this. So one of the first things you can do is you can think about polarization as being you can treat it as a spin. So what we think we're creating here is a spin 3/2 system. We've got three photons. And so it really exists as a J equals spin 3/2 system. And when you start thinking about these things in terms of spin, what you end up with is a density matrix that I think I may even have a picture of it that breaks down into this sort of block diagonal representation, where this corresponds to the symmetric J equals 3/2 space that exists. And then these are other sort of J subspaces. This would be the J equals 1/2. And it turns out that there's two of them. There's a multiplicity between them. And so you end up with this diagonalization structure.
So I have a very naive question, which is what breaks down when you do the, what would be the, you know, first inclination, which is just write down a 4x4 density matrix and hope that if you write things as mixed states, that your statistics will all work out. Since you've written it with more boxes than that, I am confident that fails. But maybe you can sum up why that's a bad idea.
So just in, sorry, I didn't understand the first part of your question. If you just wrote down in terms of
so when you back several slides ago, you wrote down a pure state, which was a superposition of 3, 0, 2, 1, 1, 2, and 0, 3, and so I think of that as a four-level system, mm-hmm. And so that's a 4x4 density matrix. And naively, I think, well, things that mess that up should be entangling to external degrees of freedom, which then creates an incoherent superposition of those pure states. And now I have some mixed density matrix. And that's a 4x4 Hermitian matrix. And I'm wondering why that's a bad idea.
So suppose you just have two photons, and they're actually distinguishable.
Yes.
And in particular, they're in the singlet state, which they couldn't be in if they weren't distinguishable.
Yes.
Okay? But I go ahead and I just make however many measurements I need to do tomography on the 3x3 space. I make my 9 measurements. I reconstruct some 3x3 matrix.
Mm-hmm.
That 3x3 matrix describes some symmetric state of the photons that is consistent with my measurements, which is different from the singlet state, which is also consistent with my measurements. So there is some degree of freedom that I've left out. But you actually have to do the 10th measurement and directly find the projection onto the singlet state to completely characterize it.
So the density matrix
would incorrectly predict the outcome of some other measurements,
mm-hmm.
Such as a Hung-O-Mantel interferometer.
Well, if you only make, so then does that mean the density matrix is correct? If you only make measurements of the type,
no.
How many H photons and how many B photons do I get?
You mean just any pure polarization measurements? No, it's still incomplete.
Okay. So that you're wrong because you're sending different states than you would. The reason tomography fails is you're actually sending in the wrong input states as well.
I didn't follow that. But
okay.
You're wrong.
Go on. I think
that was going to be my answer too. Yeah, so it's it turns out that just like this distinguishing information in terms of the two photon case with a singlet state, there's hidden information there that you can't access. And that ends up living in either in these non-symmetric states of these lower J spin halves. And this is the represents the full symmetric part. Now, I've already told you that our apparatus, we've done the best job that we can to get rid of all this extra information. So there's no way that we are sensitive to correlations between, say, this subspace and, say, this subspace here. We have to trace that all out. Like, there's nothing we can do. Our detectors are, say, fast enough to distinguishing the timing information. So this, the result of any measurement that we can make, which is what you're interested in with this density matrix, because you want this to predict faithfully any, to use it as a faithful prediction if you were to make any measurements, this does that. It accurately represents the outcome of any of your measurements. And so you get this very interesting block diagonal structure, and it's the population of these non-symmetric terms that provide a boundary or give you a bound on the amount of distinguishing information. I think it's actually a lower bound. So this tells you, even though you don't have direct access to what's screwing up your experiment, you do know that there is some distinguishing information that that shows up there. And these elements here are kind of like this. For the higher dimension, other than two, they're kind of like generalized singlet, the equivalent of what you would get for singlet state measurements, but more complicated than that, not directly.
Chris, one, is it is easy for you to show how to predict the results of a measurement and a lesson, or is it the math too complicated and it's hard to see? I guess I don't have an intuition to what
the elements represent?
Yeah, there's small boxes in the corners. If those are big, do all the other elements in the upper left corner go to zero? Or
Yeah, it's traced.
It's traced one.
It's a reduced density.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yes.
First, you need to measure those bottom ones, is otherwise you're measuring a post-selected state, right? You can't just get rid of a subspace like you can get rid of the subsystem by tracing out, because that requires post-selection.
But also the point is we're assuming, as you were saying before, that we can make any polarization measurements we like, but no other measurements. We make permutation blind measurements, and the consequence of that is that we have no access to all of those off diagonals that are just white here. Any coherence between sectors of different spin would actually relate to the ordering of the particles.
I see.
So if we only make ordering blind measurements, then those become irrelevant.
I see. And if you could take all of the appropriate measurements, you could fill in that whole density matrix, and then it would just be like a normal density matrix that I.
If the particles were completely distinguished, otherwise there isn't even really any meaning to it. Right. If they overlap in the other degrees of freedom, then I can't completely distinguish HD from VH.
Then can I think of this as I take a density matrix of the 4x4. And apply and use that to measure all the stuff that's non-distinguishable, and then take a density matrix 8x8 that's all distinguishable, and then I just add them probabilistically. I add them incoherently.
Maybe.
Okay.
There's 6 minutes.
Okay. All right. So this is good. The other thing I want to say about this idea of, you know, here we have potentially 3 qubits if they're completely distinguishable to these 3 distinguishable particles. This, I think there's a deep connection here between some of the compression ideas that were mentioned earlier and trying to map from essentially these type of systems. So I think there's definitely a connection with the scaling and also with this type of approach and the symmetries of the system. So, I should also mention there's a multiplicity here between these two subspaces. So to do tomography, you really only need to measure these 16 elements and then 4 elements here, because you end up distributing this probability over those two. And that relates to having to trace out over this over your experiment and so on. So anyway, here's some density matrices that we've measured for various different states. And the next part of my talk is related directly to some of the stuff that Joe was talking about, and yeah, DNA. So, so if you want to know what Joe looked like, so I've been playing around with these type of systems for a really long time, and it gets very difficult to look at this skyscraper picture of what the density matrix looks like and come up with a way of visualizing it. So the way I liken this to is if you were to take a sunflower and you want to know everything about a sunflower, well, in a sense, an informational and complete viewer needs to take its DNA and look at it. And you can find out all sorts of like wonderful things about it, but it's not clear what's really going on. If instead you were to walk into a museum and see Van Gogh's representation of it, suddenly this makes a lot more sense. If you'd never seen this and were trying to figure out what it looked like based on the DNA, it'd be almost impossible to do. And so what we want to do is, to me, this is your complete representation of the state. It contains everything you want, but it can be quite opaque to just look at it and see what features are there. So the question is, what can we do to come up with a sunflower approach? And the first thing you might say is, well, for any of these quantum states that we're creating, they're polarization states. And traditionally, you represent polarization on the Bloch sphere, or sorry, on the Poincaré sphere. And these different axes just correspond to your different Stokes vectors. And a classical pure polarization is just some point on this surface. And it's very natural to see what happens to this polarization. And so you can ask, what would the state of one of our triphotons look like on such a Poincaré sphere? And this is a cartoonist school from Ephraim. But the difference instead of now, if we go to a quantum Poincaré sphere, so we're no longer looking at Stokes parameters, but we have Stokes operators, which are here, the first thing you notice is these guys do not commute, so you're going to have some uncertainty. So it's not sufficient just to represent your state as a single point. Instead, you're going to have to go to some uncertainty distribution for polarization. And we use quasi-probability distributions that are constructed from Wigner functions. And this is just the Wigner function that you can reconstruct from our density matrix. This was first, we first found out about it by Agarwal, did some work in the early 80s on it. And we used this paper, and then it was pointed out that, like all good theory, the Russians had done it in the 50s. So this was actually done originally in the 50s for how to represent spin systems. What does their Wigner function actually look like? So the first state that you can think about is a coherent state that was mentioned. And these are spin coherent states, and they correspond to having all of your spins aligned in the same direction, which is equivalent in a different basis to just getting a binomial distribution of your spin states. So you can, it's fairly easy to prove this relationship. And you're also going to get some uncertainty in the Stokes parameters. And what this shows up for on the state, so here we have three right-handed circularly polarized photons. This corresponds to having circular polarization, at least right-handed circular polarization. And you're going to get some quasi-probability distribution that's centered around this axis with some uncertainty in either basis. And this is what the density matrix looks like. And you can see in this basis, you're going to get a nice sort of binomial distribution of the elements. So, and if you rotated that density matrix around, you get all of a sudden all of the population in one of these elements here. So this is what we call a spin coherent state.
So red means I have a high probability of measuring photons in that polarization?
Exactly. And blue, it goes to zero. And then dark blue, which isn't shown here for this coherent state, corresponds to negative probabilities.
So, okay. So red means the darkest red you can have means I'm going to measure
You're most likely to find that this is where your three photons, their polarization point.
Okay, so somehow it's the expectation value of the number of photons I will measure with that measure.
Yeah,
it's proportional to that.
It's related to that.
It's related.
So this is not a Q function, but a Wigner function. Yes.
This is the Wigner function.
So it can be negative, but for this state, it's not negative.
So it turns out it is. The spin coherent states, just because of the geometry of the sphere, the orthogonal coherent states, like the one that's pointed at the antipode of this guy, for the overlap of them to be zero, there has to be a small amount of negativity, and it's an artifact of the geometry of the sphere. And this was something we initially hoped. We said, oh, look, there's negativity, it's entangled, or something quantum is going on. But that caused us a lot of problems. We had to go to a different measure to sort of show we had entanglement later on. So
when I think of a Wigner function, I think of adding that negative number to some positive numbers. When I draw a line through it and I add them all up, and that's the probability of doing that homodyne detection. Do I add up several points in the sphere here to get the result of a measurement, or is that just not transfer?
You can do things like calculate the marginals and various. Things like that. I'm not sure if that's. Yeah, it's not obvious. Like the way you calculate these is fairly complicated. It's not trivial.
Got it.
So I'd also like to point out that you can go from just having this nice smooth coherent state with this nice uncertainty that's a distribution that's symmetric. You can start to squeeze it and reduce the uncertainty in one axis, increase it in the other. And it turns out if you keep squeezing, you end up with the new state where you squeeze all the way around the sphere, and this gives you the smallest feature size that you can possibly measure and is the maximum squeeze state in some sense. And I'll talk about that really quickly in a moment. Here's the experimental results from what we've done. Here we start with the coherent state. We change our partial polarizer, and we change the polarization states, and we squeeze from the coherent state smoothly through to what's called a phase state, which is an equal superposition of all the different polarization components until you reach a mean state. And then this is just all these states spinning around because this is a three-dimensional picture. So to make this a little bit easier, here are different projections of this three-dimensional picture, and here it is unwrapped. So this is the coherent state. And then as you start to squeeze the phase state, you reduce your uncertainty in one direction. It also turns out that this state is good for measuring phases with sub-Schott noise limit, but it doesn't has a singular symmetry around the surface. So you would be able to measure a phase quite easily, like a global phase, and not have to worry about the fact that the mean state has this multiple symmetry and you don't know exactly where you're ending up. This new state is threefold symmetric. It has very, very narrow features, which are some of the things people get excited about. And so for me, our group, we never realized this connection was squeezing until we start to look at these pictures. And all of a sudden, these density matrix, it was much simpler to see some of those visualizations. You can see the effects of the new state as opposed to just a bunch of bars. On a density matrix, you can see that it has this symmetry, and you can rotate this around the point gray sphere. You know, something that would make it look completely unintelligible in density matrix format, you can see the features quite clearly. So this has helped me out quite a bit. How much time do I have left?
Well, we're in the questions. So you did field some questions already. Maybe another minute if you need something.
All right. So. Maybe I'll talk about this and then stop. I have a couple more things, but here, when people talk about squeezing and precision measurements, they always quote, like, here's the Schott noise limit, and then, you know, we squeeze and we've reduced the variance in one Stokes parameter and our uncertainty, and we've increased the uncertainty in the other Stokes parameter. So if you take what we consider to be our classical state, which is our spin coherent state, and you measure it, it's got a variance that sits pretty much right at the Schott noise limit. And then as you just measure the uncertainty in these Stokes parameters as you move along, things proceed quite nicely, and you decrease in your uncertainty, and you continue to increase in the conjugate parameter. And something strange happens. You keep squeezing, and all of a sudden, your uncertainty starts shooting up again. And this is a consequence of the fact that we have squeezed so much, we are limited by the topography of, or the topology of the sphere itself, where now we're squeezing around it. And so just taking simple uncertainty measurements, which are, in this case, only second order, the projection, it looks like you're increasing your uncertainty again, even though you have these really small uncertainty regions. So we squeezed hard enough that the polarization, this topology of this SCT topology of the sphere, becomes quite important. And we call this over-squeezing.
Excuse me, are these experimental points or theory?
These are experimental.
Will you tell how you measured it?
Yes, we got the density matrix, and then we calculated what the uncertainty would have been. So the variance for each of these different states. So we prepared each of these states, and then we calculated what we would have gotten if we did the measurements. So one way to think about it, a lot of squeezing experiments in the past have dealt with really large numbers of photons. If you were to think about the size of the Poincaré sphere, if the Poincaré sphere was like the size of this building, then their distributions would occupy something on the surface that would be like that big. And that's just because there's like huge numbers of photons involved. So in a lot of these types of experiments, the polarization experiments previously, all of the squeezing has been done in this regime where if you were to really plot what's going on in the Poincaré sphere in terms of these Wigner functions, you're only accessing a really small region. And sure, you can get huge amounts of squeezing, like 10 dB, and people get quite excited about this. But because we've reduced the number of photons, we're able to access the full surface of the sphere, and we can squeeze completely around it. And there's a really deep connection between this, between the squeezing and also the multi-photon entangled states that, like, for example, mean states that people use. Like, so there's a direct connection between this type of squeezing and the type of entangling metrology states people have used. So I think I'm going to stop there. I just had a couple of other things. Leave with a picture of this rotating around.